I've noticed on the news, it seems like you can't listen or read the news or watch the news without yet another person has been accused of some inappropriate behavior. And what I'm finding fascinating is how readily people accept the bad news. The assumption is the person's guilty. Now, sometimes they are because they admit they had done it. But there are also people who are saying, no, that did not happen. And it doesn't matter. The people are still pressured into leaving their job or being fired. And I sometimes wonder, you know, our country has this supposedly this idea that you're innocent until proven guilty. But I'm told, and in fact I've had this discussion with a few people, well, the people that are bringing these accusations, they have credible sounding stories. Isn't that proof? Shouldn't we have sympathy because these people have been victimized? And so we should sympathize with the people who have been traumatized by whatever had happened. I want you to think about that as we look at what Jesus said in John chapter 7. John chapter 7 and in verse 24. It says, "Do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment." This statement is in a section that starts from about verse 14 down to verse 24. And in that section, Jesus is accused, and I won't take time to read it, but I do invite you to do so. Jesus is accused of being uneducated. He's accused of having a demon. He's accused of breaking the law, particularly the Sabbath law. And for that, people had already decided that he should be put to death. And there wasn't even a trial to examine the evidence. And I want you to think about tonight, and that's really what we're going to look at today, is what exactly constitutes good evidence? Because we hear things all the time. I teach a course that's supposed to get people ready for college. It's not my favorite course, but I have to teach it. But one of the things that's in there is deciding who's credible. You know, any source on the internet doesn't mean that therefore it is a credible source. Just because it was written down doesn't make it credible. Just because somebody made a video of it. That one I find more fascinating. More people will give credence to a video than to a written document. But just because somebody can make a video doesn't mean it's credible. So what makes credible evidence? Well, number one is suspicion is not proof. Take a look at Numbers chapter 5. This is a case where we have a jealous husband who believes his wife is running around on him, but he doesn't actually have proof. He only has suspicions. In Numbers chapter 5 and verse 29, it says, "This law of jealousy, when a wife, being under the authority of her husband, goes astray and defiles herself, or when a spirit of jealousy comes over the man, and he is jealous of his wife, he shall then make the woman stand before the Lord, and the priest shall apply all this law to her. Moreover, the man will be free from guilt, but that woman shall bear her guilt." What is required here is that there has to be further fact-finding. Now, if the woman has not cheated on her husband. She so testifies before the Lord, and she's supposed to drink a certain special water. Then either the Lord causes her to waste away if she was lying, or she's fine, and the husband is then forbidden from ever divorcing his wife. Period. Because he was inappropriately suspicious of her. But notice the suspicion of her does not constitute evidence. It didn't prove anything other than the fact that the husband's jealous. That's the only thing it proved. It didn't prove that whether she was right or wrong. In fact, if you look at Proverbs 18 and verse 13, there's a warning here. Proverbs 18, verse 13. He who gives an answer before he hears, it is folly and a shame to him. To make a decision based on no evidence, well, to put it bluntly, it's dumb. You don't do that. You need to find out, suspicion is fine. You need to check it. There's a reason maybe behind the suspicion, but you need to check. But that doesn't mean you make a conclusion at that point. Now, along with that, accusations don't make proof either. And the reason for that is people can lie. And we seem to forget about that. In Leviticus 19, and verse 16. You shall not go about as a slanderer among your people, and you are not to act against the life of your neighbor. I am the Lord. You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but shall not incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance, nor bear a grudge against any of the sons of your people. But you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. You are to keep my statutes. And it continues on. I want to stop there. But notice what it is. People could slander. That's why there's a law against it. And they could do so because of hatred or a desire for revenge. There could be a lot of reasons why they lie about somebody else's reputation. In fact, as we talked about this morning, Jeremiah faced a lot of opposition. And in Jeremiah chapter 20, one of those things that happened to him was slander. He was accused of things. In Jeremiah 20 and verse 10, something we read this morning says, "For I have heard whisperings of many, terror on every side. Denounce them." Yes, let us denounce them. "All my trusted friends watching for my fall says, perhaps he will be deceived so that we may prevail against him and take our revenge on him." They're just waiting for Jeremiah to make a slip so they can pounce on him. And it's not because they think Jeremiah's wrong. Well, they just don't like Jeremiah. They want revenge on Jeremiah for the things that he's been saying. Now, like what we said before, when you talk about making a decision without any proof, spreading slander is also dumb. Take a look at Proverbs chapter 10. Proverbs 10 and verse 18. "He who conceals hatred has lying lips, and he who spreads slander is a fool." He's talking about spreading the slander. In other words, somebody told you a juicy story about somebody else. And then you just pass it on. Why is that dumb? Because how do you know that other person didn't lie? How do you know whether that slander is actually true or false? Think about how many people, I've been getting a lot of them lately on Facebook. People, don't accept this person's friendship. Well, who's that person? Do you even know that person? I certainly don't. And all I get is a name. You know how many people have the same name in the world? But don't accept that person's friendship. You know where that probably started? Somebody's mad at their boyfriend or girlfriend. But people spread it over and over and over again. How many people spread things about, you know, shots? About whether, you know, you get autism from it? You know that there's been several studies that look very closely at it. So far, everyone says no. But it spread rapidly all over the place. All the time I get people spreading something and they never check the facts. We're not to be that type of people. We want good, solid evidence. And an accusation is not evidence. It doesn't matter how many people agree. Because people tend to follow the masses. We're going to show a verse for that in just a little bit. Now, public leaders are especially vulnerable to that. Because as we mentioned before, public leaders out front. And so they're targets. Because there are a lot of people that want to take them down regardless. And we should keep that in mind. That's why in 1 Timothy chapter 5, there's a rule about elders that's mentioned. And it's there for good reason. 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 19 says, do not receive an accusation against an elder except on the basis of two or three witnesses. Okay. Why? Because there are going to be people who want to take an elder down. Because usually they've got the wonderful job of saying, you know what, you can't do that. And their answer to that is, well, we'll just get rid of the eldership and I won't be told I can't do anything. And so you got to be careful. So Timothy was told, you can't just take somebody's word for it. You need at least two or three witnesses. In fact, that idea comes from Deuteronomy chapter 19 and verse 15, that there has to be multiple witnesses. In Deuteronomy 19, verse 15, a single witness shall not rise up against a man on account of any iniquity or any sin which he has committed. On the evidence of two or three witnesses, a matter shall be confirmed. That's a pretty broad and straightforward statement. And by the way, this is not just to the leadership. This is about everybody. A single accusation isn't enough. Especially accusing somebody of sin. In fact, Jesus pointed out, though Jesus never lies, Jesus never told an untruth, Jesus still said that if it was just on his word only. Take a look at what he says in John chapter 5. It's not on his word only, but he's saying if. If I alone testify about myself, my testimony is not true. He could tell the absolute truth, but you cannot say that is truth based on one person, one witness. It's not enough. And oh, I wish people would use that these days. Think about how many people have been told that they have to step down from office or can't run for office or whatever based on one accusation. I don't care how much evidence is stated or how much is stated or how real the story sounds, it's still one person. It's not enough to make a conclusion. In fact, when you have a witness, the other requirement is a witness has to have personal knowledge of the facts that are being testified. Take a look at Jeremiah chapter 32. Jeremiah 32, starting with verse 9. I bought the field which was at Anath from Hamnel, my uncle's son, and I weighed out the silver for him, 17 shekels of silver. I signed and sealed the deed and called in witnesses and weighed out the silver on the scales. Then I took the deeds of purchase, both the sealed copy containing the terms and conditions and the open copy, and I gave the deed of purchase to Barak, the son of Neri, the son of Meshaiah, in the sight of Hamael, my uncle's son, and in the sight of the witnesses who signed the deed of purchase before all the Jews who were sitting in the court of the guard. Do you notice how careful this is being done? I'm buying it for a certain amount of silver. I weighed the silver in front of witnesses. I then signed the documents in front of witnesses. They then signed the document. There was a requirement for multiple witnesses, and the witnesses had to personally see it to make it true. And those witnesses, when we talk about witnesses, I need to also understand it has to be independent witnesses. For example, maybe this will make it a little clearer. You got three people testifying that Jack said that Jill stole a watch. Well, all that establishes is that Jack believes that Jill stole the watch. That's one witness. That three people heard him make the accusation doesn't make it three witnesses or four witnesses. It doesn't. It's just one witness of an accusation. Three witnesses of a single accusation. It doesn't prove that Jill actually stole the watch. Because there's really only one witness, Jack. It's not enough. Now, also implying on all this, that when you have witnesses, the implication here is the witnesses have to agree to the story. They have to agree to what they're witnessing about. Take a look at John chapter 8. John chapter 8 and verse 17. Even in your law it has been written that the testimony of two men is true. And by implication there, it means that they're saying the same thing. And when we say they're saying the same thing, it doesn't mean every single detail necessarily has to be the same. Because, after all, people are people. Somebody might remember certain facts, and one of those things that they remember is different from what another person. But say that there's five things and points in the story. But one of them is disagreed on. Well, at least you have four things that have been witnessed to. So you don't take the entire story as a whole doesn't have to be exactly the same. Back, take a look at 2 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 1. 2 Corinthians 13 and verse 1. It says, "This is the third time I'm coming to you. Every fact is to be confirmed by the testimony of two or three witnesses." Each fact. Now, the reason why I want to point this out is sometimes people get all upset about the fact that the Gospels, they don't say exactly the same thing. Now, we go through there and we can show you that they all harmonize. But should I get upset that they're not word for word the same? Well, what? If they were, then we have three books, or four books, and it'd be kind of boring reading them. But that's not witnesses. But you know, you can take every fact in the story and it's confirmed at least for the most part by one or two or four. You know, you get other the Gospels, they talk about the same fact. Maybe Mark and Luke talk about one fact and John talks and Matthew talk about another fact. But there's still multiple witnesses to each of the facts for the most part. There's just few that maybe one or two small things that are maybe not multiple witnesses. So in other words, if witness A says that he saw the defendant get out of a red car and walk into the bank, and witness B says he saw the defendant walk out of the bank with a sack, you know what you establish? That the guy was in the bank. You don't know if it really was a red car. You don't know if he really walked out with a sack. Because each of those facts are only by one witness. It's not that those things are not true. They both can be true. But we haven't have multiple witnesses. Now, also the witnesses have to be credible. Take a look at Deuteronomy 17. Deuteronomy 17, and starting with verse 2. If there is found in your midst, in any of your towns, which the Lord your God is giving you, a man or a woman who does what is evil in the sight of the Lord your God by transgressing his covenant, and has gone and served other gods and worshipped them, or the sun or the moon or any heavenly host which I have not commanded, and if it is told you, and you have heard of it, then you shall inquire thoroughly. Behold, if it is true, and the thing is certain, that it is a detestable thing that has been done in Israel, then you shall bring that man or that woman who has done this evil deed to your gates, that is the man or woman whom you shall stone, and shall stone him to death. On the evidence of two or three witnesses, he who is to die shall be put to death. He shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. Nothing is accepted on face value. You heard somebody say an accusation was made. What do they have to do? The law required. You investigate it thoroughly. And only if you have multiple witnesses from the investigation do you actually accept it. You have to also remember that when you got somebody making an accusation, they're the first witness. People have a tendency to be biased towards the first thing they hear. Take a look at Proverbs chapter 18. Proverbs 18 and verse 17. The first to plead his case seems right until another comes and examines him. When somebody says something, we tend to accept it. We tend to, and that's not a bad thing, we tend to think people are telling the truth. But we got to remember there are people who lie. There are people who get their facts wrong. So not until I examine it do I accept it. Now one of the things that we got to keep in mind too is that witnesses don't have to be people. I'm not going to take time to go through all these verses. But in Exodus 22 and verse 13, there's talking about where you keep an animal and the animal dies because some wild animal killed it. Well, the guy was supposed to bring the carcass as one of the evidence, witness. In fact, he used the word witness. As a witness to the fact that, hey, I didn't do this. I didn't butcher him and use it for my table meal. in Genesis 31 and verse 48. There was a set of stones that were piled up as a witness that a covenant was made. In Deuteronomy 22 and verse 17, if a husband marries a wife that he thought was a virgin and she claims to be a virgin, and then he says, oh no, she wasn't, there was supposed to be a cloth brought that shows whether there was blood on the cloth. That was a witness. You know, if we were living in the with similar set of laws, DNA would count as a witness. It wouldn't be enough by itself to trigger a death penalty. After all it says is that the material containing the DNA was found at the scene of the crime. It doesn't testify how it got to the crime scene. So it's the only one witness. It's not enough. What's fascinating, even a song can be a witness. That's in Deuteronomy 31. Moses had them learn a song to remember so it would be a witness against them when they violated the terms. In Deuteronomy 31, 19 to 21. And so God has witnesses of himself. We'll take a look at this one. Acts chapter 14. Acts chapter 14. And verse 17. Yet he did not leave himself without witness, in that he did good and gave you rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. How do you know there is a God? Well, one of the witnesses is, hey, God provides food for us by rains and growing seasons. That's a witness. Even death could be a witness. Take a look at Revelation 12. Revelation chapter 12 and verse 11. And they overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb and because of the word of their testimony. They did not love their life even in the face of death. What's fascinating is that the word for witness in Greek is martyria, is which we get the word martyr from. The fact that people were willing to die for their faith becomes a witness. Now the law very clearly says it's against the law to be a false witness. It's one of the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20 and verse 16. If there's a law there, it's because people might do so. And so when you have a witness, the witness, what the witness states has to be consistently truthful. Take a look at Proverbs chapter 12. Proverbs chapter 12 and in verse 17. He who speaks truth tells what is right, but a false witness deceit. You have a truthful witness, the things they say are going to be consistently true. If you got a person who's saying lie after lie after lie, and then there's a couple of truths mixed into it, how do you know which ones are the truths? And so the witness has to be consistently truthful. Also take a look at Proverbs 14, verse 15. The naive believes everything. 14 verse 5, it's what I wanted. A trustworthy witness will not lie, but a false witness utters lies. So in other words, if you got contradictions on important points, then that would cause the evidence to be tossed out of court. You can't establish the main points, then why worry about the little details if the big points are not consistent? So that explains, for instance, why in Jesus' trial, they couldn't bring up witnesses in that trial. They had people testify, lots of people. But in Matthew chapter 26, notice what it says about his trial. And in verse 59, Matthew 26, starting with verse 59. Now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Jesus so they might put him to death. They did not find any, even though many false witnesses came forward. But later on, two came forward and said, this man stated, I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. They went through testimony after testimony after testimony. They finally got two people to say the same thing on one fact. But think about why did Matthew call them all false witnesses? Because all the other things were not consistent. This evidence should have been tossed out. One other thing also about witnesses that we got to keep in mind is in Exodus 23. And to keep in mind, especially when you talk about somebody who's testifying about some very emotional type of thing, we have sympathy for the underdog, for the victim. And we ought to, but we have to keep in mind that that doesn't make it so. Because even somebody who has a very good-sounding testimony might lie. Even a poor person might lie. In Exodus 23, in verse 2, you shall not be partial to a poor man in a dispute. It's an interesting thing. You think, well, you should have a law saying you don't be partial to the rich person. No, a lot of people don't like rich people. But there is a tendency to go the other direction, the other extreme. Because a person's poor, I sympathize with him, therefore he must be right. Not necessarily true. There can be no partiality just because somebody's an apparent victim. And we, like I've been saying many, many times, people can lie. David faced many false witnesses against him. In Psalms chapter 27, Psalms 27, starting with verse 12, says, do not deliver me over to the desire of my adversaries, for false witnesses have arisen against me, and such breathe out violence. It's not surprising that a public figure, even one who was, for the most part, loved, David had his detractors when he was king. False witnesses have motivations to destroy public figures. And a common tactic is to accuse a person of something he doesn't know anything about. Take a look at Psalm 35. Psalm 35 and verse 11. Malicious witnesses rise up. They ask me of things that I do not know. Why do they do that? Because you look like you're stumbling. Because you don't know how to answer it. It comes out of the blue. What? And no matter how you try to say no, it sounds like you're not as believable as a person who has the polished story that brings the accusation. See, that was one of the alarm bells when I was listening to just on the news about Judge Moore. I don't know if Judge Moore is a good person for the Senate or not. That doesn't matter. What rang my alarm bells was this woman had an accusation. Everybody was sympathizing on her because she was the victim. And Judge Moore said, no, this is not right. And all through the news, it was like, oh, he's just saying that. Well, what is a person who's supposed to, suddenly accused of something supposed to say? and if it happens to be false. What else can you say? You know, everybody was praising all the people that got accused, and they said, "Oh yeah, that's right. I need to step down." Well, that's good. They stepped down. They, you know, that's good. But there are some people that get lied about. And this is the verse that we need to keep in mind. False witnesses also tend to follow crowds. Take a look at Exodus chapter 23. Exodus 23. And verses 1 and 2. You shall not bear a false report. Do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not follow the masses in doing evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice. It's a bandwagon approach. Have you noticed that? One person makes an accusation, and the next week there's two other people, three other people. They start ganging up. People follow. Oh, one person got away with it. I'll do too, and I'll do too. There's a specific law saying don't do that. See, the problem, again, is that we have this tendency to believe the bad things about people. Take a look at Proverbs 18. And in verse 8. Proverbs 18, and in verse 8. The words of a whisperer are like dainty morsels. They go down into the innermost parts of the body. Tasty little treats. And so when somebody says something right, people's okay, or nice. But when somebody says, oh, that person did X, something bad, there's a tendency to jump on and believe it. And we got to watch out for that. In Proverbs 24 and in verse 28, it says, do not be a witness against your neighbor without cause, and do not deceive with your lips. Some people say bad things for no apparent reason. They say lies for no apparent reason. Proverbs also warns us that wicked people tend to pay attention to evil news. It's something that's on their mind. In Proverbs 17, verse 4, an evildoer listens to the wicked lips. A liar pays attention to the destructive tongue. That's, again, something we've got to watch out for. And when witnesses disagree, they're supposed to be investigated. Back to Proverbs, or Deuteronomy, sorry. Deuteronomy 19. Deuteronomy 19, verse 16. If a malicious witness rises up against a man to accuse him of wrongdoing, then both the men who have the dispute shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and the judges, who will be in office in those days. The judges shall investigate thoroughly. And if the witness is a false witness, he has accused his brother falsely, you shall do to him just as he intended to do to his brother. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you. The rest will hear and be afraid and will never do again such an evil thing among you. Thus you shall not show no pity, life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Think about if that was one of our laws. Okay. You accuse somebody and you turn out that they prove that you lied in court. You got what that person would have gotten if they believed your testimony. With no mercy. Make you think about your testimonies anyway. But notice again, there is a basic assumption, just because you got a testimony and you got a conflict, You resolve it by investigation, thorough investigation. And there was no escape from the punishment. Going over to Proverbs chapter 19 and in verse 5. Proverbs 19 and verse 5. A false witness shall not go unpunished, and he who tells lies will not escape. Now, since we're talking about witnesses, I want to throw in a little bit as well. Being a witness under the Old Testament law wasn't a passive act. First off, if you didn't give evidence when charged to testify, that would make you an accomplice to the crime. In Leviticus 5 and in verse 1, Leviticus 5 and verse 1, now if a person sins after he hears a public adjuration to testify that he is a when he is a witness, whether he has seen or otherwise known, if he does not tell it, then he will bear his guilt. If they're asking for witnesses and you keep your mouth shut, then you're a partner in the crime, is what God's saying. In fact, take a look at Proverbs 29 and verse 24. He who is a partner with a thief hates his own life. He who hears the oath but tells nothing. You become a partner with the person. In fact, that was the law that the high priest used against Jesus. Jesus was giving him the silent treatment. And so finally, the high priest, even though there is another law saying that you don't self-incriminate, but it wasn't an incrimination. But in Matthew chapter 26, starting with verse 62, after the malicious witnesses had testified, it says, the high priest stood up and said to him, "Do you not answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you?" But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest said to him, "I adjure you, by the living God, that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God." By that law, now, because he was commanded to make witness, by that law he had to answer, because he knew the truth. He was a witness to that. And Jesus said to him, "You have said it yourself, nevertheless I tell you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his robes and said, "He has blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses? Behold, you now have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" And he answered, "He deserves death." A couple of problems there. One witness. Remember Jesus said, if I just testify myself, it's not true? Two, there's a law also against self-incrimination. That was in the Old Testament. And three, they assumed that what Jesus testified was false. They didn't investigate it thoroughly. Because what Jesus actually testified was truth. Now, if you were in a murder trial under the old law, take a look at Leviticus 24. Leviticus 24. And in verse 17, if a man takes the life of any other human being, he shall surely be put to death. And that was not the one I wanted. Now I'm going to have to go look that one up again. I apologize. There is a verse somewhere in Leviticus, I'm pretty sure, that basically said the witnesses had to lay their hands on the criminal after they, if he was convicted. You know, you lay hands on people when you bless them. But this is to testify that they are they had foretold the truth. And in Deuteronomy 17 and verse 17, hopefully I wrote that one down right. Deuteronomy 17 and verse 7. It says, the hand of the witnesses shall be the first against them to put them to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. The witnesses in a murder trial were the first ones to throw the stones. Why? So that they knew the responsibility of what they said in convicting a person. It was a serious matter. There's no hands off, hey, this wasn't me. 24:14, Leviticus 24:14. Yes, let the one who is cursed outside the camp, and let all who heard him lay their hands on his head, then let all the congregation stone him. God was not allowing people just to accuse and run. They had to participate. Now, what does that mean for you and I? We've talked about some of the applications. Now, when a person brings an accusation, especially against a public figure, don't jump on the bandwagon condemning the person. If the accuser has a case, it ought to go to court. That's kind of straightforward. It ought to be tried. And as much as you might want to sympathize with the accuser, proper evidence must be gathered and examined. It's the only fair and just thing to do. And it's not just in the court of public arena either. Take a look at Matthew chapter 18. Now, at times there are going to be brethren who disagree with each other. There are going to be private disputes. In Matthew 18, starting with verse 15, it says, if your brother sins, go and show him his fault in private. If he listens to you, you have won your brother. I want you to take note, this is not talking about somebody who sins where everybody has heard it. This is somebody who has a dispute between two brethren, and they're the only two that really know about this. What do you do? The two of them settle it out. What if they can't settle it? Next verse. If he does not listen to you, take one or two more with you so that by the mouth of two or three witnesses, every fact may be confirmed. Well, you have a dispute. You got two people to say two different things. You need witnesses about what was said. And what kind of evidence do they present? What do you have? Now, those witnesses are not passive witnesses. They're trying to actually settle the dispute. But they're going to be functioning later as witnesses to what happened in that attempt to settle it. Now, I've seen people try to just bring witnesses along and then make false accusations. I've been a target of one of those. But it's not to just to witness the accusation. They're trying to settle and find out what the actual facts are. They're a fact-finding group. And only if it doesn't get resolved, in verse 17 it says, if he refuses to listen to them, tell it to the church, and if he refuses to listen even to the church, let him to be to you as a Gentile and a tax collector. Only if it remains unsolved does it go before the church. And now the church has to examine the evidence, not the accusations. That's just what's being accused. Evidence about what is really true. And we already have people who have gathered the facts, so it makes it a little more efficient. You know what we really need? We got plenty of people who love to make accusations in this world. But what we really need is people to settle the problems. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 5, I say this to your shame. Is it so that there is not among you one wise man who will be able to decide among his brethren? Should we not be people who can look at evidence and find out what the truth is? After all, we follow the truth. I hope you'll think about these things. If there's anyone here, again, it's not a lesson to bring people to Christ, but if there is anyone who wishes to become a child of God, there is no better time than right now to put on Christ. And for those who are children of God and would like the prayers of the brethren on your behalf, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song of the selected.